Welcome to a fine edition of My So-Called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Villegas. Joining me today, future author of Chrono Trigger, the book, Michael P. Williams.
Hi, everyone.
I never thought I'd have to... Yeah, of course, Michael... Of course, Chrono Trigger, the book, is going to be a collection of fan fiction, right? I'm just kidding.
They are awful. They are the worst things. Everyone is having sex with everyone.
I'm okay with Chrono Trigger fan fiction. Actually, okay. Completely off-the-wall topic. What is the worst piece of fan fiction you've ever read?
Wow. It's probably one I wrote when I was 13.
Okay, now you got to tell me. What have you now? You went into this now. You went this way. So.
I know. I was going to eventually. I loved Pokemon, and I cheated, and I made the super secret zero missing number, missing no Pokemon.
Right.
So I wrote an origin story for him. By now, I look like a Johnny Come Lately because everyone's like, yes, well, there's like 12 missing no sprites. So which one do you mean? Okay. I don't want to explain that much.
No, but it's the fact of the matter. You made a – okay, what was your backstory on the – okay, so to quickly explain this to everybody who's never played Pokemon, who's never quite understood it. I think the first one was back in – was it Red or Blue? I forget.
It may have been in both. I owned both cartridges because I didn't have any friends, but I had two Game Boys. So
That's all you need, two Game Boys and a microphone, and then you can make some chiptune stuff. No, but anyways, in Pokemon Red, as kind of one of the more interesting things of games, because for those who have never played like games that – couldn't have DLC and patches and updates. A lot of that stuff was just hard-coded in the game. And so with Pokemon Red, there was a glitch that you could trigger that essentially would give you this errored Pokemon. It's sort of like an error memory
dummy Pokemon that never got filled, I think. Right. I don't really know the full details. But
well, because it's something like that. And essentially it's labeled I think it's like number zero. It's like no sprite because there's no data there. And it just didn't – that's what was default. And so a lot of people have found that. There have been references in other games. Some people have said they've seen it in the latest Pokemon X and Y kind of hidden underneath a bridge. Like, is that the no one
or
not?
Yeah, it's this dangerous hobo Pokemon lurking on the edge.
Because because the thing is, if you got it, you couldn't really do much with it because it would actually corrupt your game. Like you catching that Pokemon would be this dangerous action. It's just because it's not supposed to happen. Yeah,
there's risks with cheating in any game and kind of modifying the code. But I think I remember that mine was okay. He just had a weird battle animation and made strange sounds. So it was just like this thing of wow. This needs an explanation, but the game offers no explanation.
All right, so what was your explanation?
Oh God, I don't even remember. Thank God that hard drive was wiped from the face of the earth and wiped from my memory. I only really remember this recently when I was looking at terrible fan fiction, and some of it is so inspired. But I really wanted to look at what fans were doing with Chrono Trigger because I didn't really buy what the franchise did with it. So I just wanted to see how do fans react to this. So I found things ranging from the ridiculous to the sublime on fanfiction.net, which you should totally browse.
Yes.
But I ended up buying what amounts to Chrono Trigger porn. And not just porn, it's gay porn. And not just gay porn, it's manga gay porn. Straight from Japan. Met the author. She was so nice.
Hold on. You're telling me that not only A, you bought Japanese doujinshin of Chrono Trigger. God, I forget what the Japanese gay one is. It's not yaoi.
This is yaoi.
So yaoi. Okay.
Written by a woman to make kind of, sexualized homosocial relationships. I mean, there's some graphic scenes in this.
Well, the funny part I find is that not only you bought this, not only you read it, but you tracked the woman down who wrote it.
Well, wait. I mean, obviously, if you're going to buy like someone's doujinshi, you have to talk to them and generally get it. So it's not something I bought like from a dude on the bridge.
Okay. I was under the impression you found this. You're like, I've got to find the person who wrote this.
No, it's research. I found her just by Googling around, really. I had used a website called Chrono Compendium, which is like the Chrono Trigger fan site. It's an amazing site. But this was not among the doujinshi listed on there. But I was just looking around, found this, saw that she was still actively making them as of this year, and decided to buy her entire stock of what was available. And she shipped everything to me. I was just fascinated because, wow, people still love this game. And not only did they still love it, they're still kind of remixing it in ways that, to me, are more faithful interpretations of the game than what Square ended up doing with the franchise. So, you know, I just loved it.
What's interesting, you kind of lead into like my kind of first question before we kind of go into, we'll dig in the book proper and kind of explain what the pitch is and things like that. Because like during my research, I kind of found the other works you've done. Mainly the thing that tripped me off in terms of how serious you were taking this material, was the actual Kotaku excerpt that they published, I think, recently. It's sort of what keyed me into actually finding you and digging in because, approaching Chrono Trigger, you know, Chrono Trigger is one of those RPGs, one of those Squaresoft games that's almost like a sacred cow that it's really – people never touch, never question, never really, you know, discuss about it. It's sort of this thing that, you know, we all hold up in high regard. But no one's ever really – people have made fan fictions and things like that, but no one's really ever dug into it. I got to ask before we keep on going, does that kind of make you nervous in terms of writing a book? The fact that Chrono Trigger is this sort of like, you know, you bring it up to people who grew up playing RPGs, grew up playing Squaresoft games and be like, oh, I fucking love Chrono Trigger. Holy Chrono, you know, Chrono Trigger is this great game. You got to play it. Like, does it kind of make you nervous that you're approaching this kind of topic?
Well, actually, the exact opposite makes me nervous because reading Chrono Compendium, there are diehard fans and people who have dedicated, countless hours to making Chrono Trigger fit into the continuum with Radical Dreamers, which was a sequel made for a very, it ended up being popular. Called Satellaview, which was an add-on to SNES. Really neat, revolutionary kind of gaming, although it was just too ahead of its time. And then making Radical Dreamers and Chrono Trigger fit with Chrono Cross, which is the official kind of mass market sequel to Chrono Trigger. And, you know, the staff changed between each, you know, version of the game, or sequel rather. And then meanwhile, Chrono Trigger itself has gone through several incarnations of, there's a Super Nintendo version that I played, PlayStation port, which added some new cutscenes that sort of, you know, reshape the story. And then finally, a Nintendo DS version released a few years back that adds more scenes to tie it to the later sequel. So
yeah, the Time Devourer thing with Shaw, yeah, kind of tying so that all in.
The canon of this game is so complex and so, you know, multifaceted that almost anyone who knows the game well can be correct on an issue if they're referring to a specific version of the game. So then when you get people together saying, well, I renounce Chrono Cross, or people who are saying, you know, this game is all about the continuity, you're going to have disagreements. So at Chrono Compendium, they are dedicated to making this series fit. And people have extensive theories, crazy ideas. I was afraid of, one, reading too many of them and then kind of absorbing what other people said and making fan theory into really game fact. And I was also afraid, too, of really just fucking something up bad. And already on Kotaku, there's someone saying, no, that's fucked up, sir.
And that's exactly what I'm bringing it up because, I mean, you already bring up the idea of, you just started expressing to me the knowledge of the Satellaview, Radical Dreamers, and how that ties into it. Like, I know already that you are well-versed just by you talking about these very, you know, when you talk about any game, especially the Chrono Trigger kind of, series, that being proper Chrono Trigger, Chrono Cross, and if you want to include Radical Dreamers, you can. It's more of a kind of prototype to what Chrono Cross would become.
There's a way to make it fit. Someone will always find a way to make it fit.
Well, yeah, it's like anything else, but you just bringing that up, it ensures me, A, I know you know what you're talking about, and B, I know you're going to be well-versed, but you're absolutely right when it comes to fans because they all have this idea of what the game was. And the game means something to, you know, everybody, mm-hmm. something different, especially when you talk about different versions. I mean, if you you want to put it in more perspective, you know, even wider, there's now an iPhone version of the game. And, right. and that's and a different
audience.
That's
slightly different from the DS version because some of the in-game text has things like you need to press the A button at this point. Well, there's no A button on this iPad, so what do you do? Well, the game will say, you know, swipe the screen or whatever it ends up saying. So even this game is mildly changed from what someone is playing on the DS, and if you want to get to that level of, you know, textual fidelity to the game you played, you end up having disagreements. But you're both right, because the game is both of those things at once. And, you know, my book is mainly focused on, well, I use the Super Nintendo version as the basis for analysis, but I bring in knowledge of the other versions of the game, the Japanese translation when applicable, just to get a view of what Chrono Trigger, kind of the meta game is. But I'm really focusing mainly on the game that I played, which was the Super Nintendo cartridge from 1995. So that part was not spelled out in the Kotaku article. I really wish I could have laid my terms with, like, well, guys, before you go on, remember Super Nintendo? That this is that. Nothing else happened after that, you know.
Well, because that's important to do, especially when approaching the thing. Because ultimately, when I was explaining earlier about me looking to Michael and kind of other things like that, the one thing that caught my eye was that you worked for, I think, the University of Pennsylvania under, like, the Japanese collections. Yeah. And so I started looking, trying to see what other papers you've written. One of them being, I think, you had written a paper on access to, was it Gepo?
Lord, you found that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I do my research here.
Yeah, they are kind of like little mini magazines you find within other books. It's crazy collecting. And, you know, I'm a bit of a collector, so I feel like that positions me in a good way to talk about Chrono Trigger. I have to tell you, I bought, I didn't buy, the library bought every single Japanese Chrono Trigger strategy guide published in Japan. So
holy shit.
Yeah, the University of Pennsylvania now owns all six of these. were primary sources. I used them as research.
But this is what I'm talking about, is that this is the kind of thing that really caught my eye with this book wasn't so much that you're writing about Chrono Trigger, or wasn't so much that, because ultimately, yes, Chrono Trigger is a great game, that's not me saying that, but what caught my eye was the fact that you're taking this realistic approach to it, and you kind of brought in not so much the you know, the fact that you're just like, oh, let's analyze the game for story, because anybody can do that. But the thing that caught my eye the most of that excerpt I saw on Kotaku was you digging into the idea of the chapel in the game. And I had no idea in Japan how popular, like, you know, the Western Wedding was, and how that kind of fit in. And the minute you kind of went in detail there, just talking about this one little thing in the game that anybody else would have said, oh, it's just it's the medieval times, of course, there's church, whatever. But you going into, no, this actually might mean something more. This might have a bit deeper connection because of the fact that it's a Japanese game, and because this is sort of how the culture is there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that the Japanese story writers necessarily had an idea of what medieval looks like, what Western medieval looks like. I mean, yeah, that's probably there, and they could have been influenced by any number of sources. But it's true that these institutions do exist in Japan, but they're not the same way we would interpret them. So religion in Chrono Trigger, the chapel, for instance, is really a non-location. You just go there because it's suspicious for some reason. It's just another building. But the context for it is, well, we have this ceremonial building. No one goes there. There's just some nuns hanging out. Worshippers don't go. No one, you know, goes to pray to anyone. It's just this weird thing that is also amazingly huge. So it's a showpiece. And I kind of wanted to figure out why this is there and how it resonated with the fact that I visited a place like this in Japan and just was amazed at how awesome and beautiful and completely empty it was. And, you know, that's sort of this performance of religion as well as it is, let's make this thing look medieval. So, you know, it combines a couple of details and sensibilities. And that's kind of what I want to explore. Well, I have been exploring really through the book. I hope I don't have to do too much more. I've been writing for months.
We're going to definitely dig in more. But before we go further, before we even start talking more about the premise of the book and things like that, we gotta learn a little bit about the man. We got to learn a little bit about the man behind the books and such.
Okay.
We got to see some credentials, so to speak.
Oh boy. Well, I have an article about Gepo, if you're interested.
It's like I wrote two things of what, you know, I'm totally, like, does that make me, no, like what I mean, especially, and we've already kind of touched on this a little bit in the pre-show and that. What is your earliest memory of Chrono Trigger?
It would be, I mean, I remember just turning it on and having that pendulum swinging back and forth. And it's just this it kind of zooms in, and I just thought, wow, this game is trippy. It wasn't an introduction that's just text. It was something that's saying, this is cinema, and we're making a movie for you to play. And I just remember that. You go into the world, and everything looks so beautiful. It's just this amazing... I mean, is it 16-bit? Is it 32-bit? At that point, I don't really know. It's a 32-bit.
It's technically...
24-bit-ish, you know. It's
Now we're getting into the
I don't
very
know these
specific
details.
Things.
I don't want to go down this line.
Yeah, let's leave it be.
But it was beautiful, and it was so, I don't know, pastoral and inviting, but you knew adventure was going to happen. It just felt different than other games. Like, I was big into the Final Fantasy series. Final Fantasy 4, 6, I mean, 2 and 3 here, they just kind of start in media res, and all of a sudden you're on an adventure and you don't even know it. But with Chrono Trigger, you just can walk around and have fun for a while and just explore before the game ever says, oh, guess what? You got to play a game. There's a mission for you to complete. And I think I was really impressed with just how free I felt to, you know, make this little tiny blocky sprite walk around a world and no one was telling me what to do.
For me, the earliest memory still is, I think it was a US commercial, and I've never been able to find a copy of it. And
it's not available. So in my book, I interviewed Ted Woolsey, who's a translator.
Oh my God, you're bringing this up even better.
He was part of the marketing department of Square, so I think he helped produce that commercial to some degree. He told me that one of his kids taped over the commercial on VHS.
Oh God, because that was like literally, like, there is a line of, you know, travel through time, lose your luggage, that's like stuck in my head and can never get out, and I've never been able to find that commercial.
It's deep in Nintendo's archives.
It's got to be somewhere, because it was all in Japanese, and I remember, like, it was like Squaresoft, Shinhotsubai. Like, I don't even know what that means, because I'm not a Japanese. I don't speak Japanese, and
Did you just say Squaresoft Shinhotsubai?
I think that's what it said in the commercial, if I'm not mistaken.
You are amazing at remembering that.
This is okay. My mutant ability is that my brain is the stupid. Like, everyone else's brain can dedicate to, like, you know, physics or curing cancer or doing something important. My brain is somehow like keys in on very, very specific pop culture things.
That's truly impressive.
And so my brain remembers that because it was such a moving commercial for me. It was such a kind of thing because, you know, at that time, like, my first RPG experience was Final Fantasy IV, which would have been 2. And so, you know, I see a game about time travel, and I'm, you know, I was at the time in the Back of the Future, all these other kind of things. And I'm like, this game looks awesome. Holy crap. And my other memory was my parents giving me that for Christmas and just me being super ecstatic, just popping into Super Nintendo, playing it. I have probably played Chrono Trigger so many times that I think that's the only reason my battery on my memory backup thing is still alive.
Wow.
Because I have, let's see, let's go down the list for me, my credentials, so to speak. I've had Chrono Trigger on the Super Nintendo, the PlayStation, and the DS. The only ones I'm missing right now are my iPhone version that I need to get still, and the PSN downloadable version of the PlayStation 1 on the PS3. Because for me, Chrono Trigger was that, like, really first RPG that I can remember playing and I remember getting into, and it had all these, like, really cool functionality in terms of not only were you traveling through time and correcting things and kind of doing stuff like that, but you had this new game plus mechanic that let you do all these cool endings. Heck, I remember, like, the developer's ending kind of thing that you could get. But yeah, so for me, this game is, like, you know, it's embedded in my skull. So when it comes to you taking to doing this, especially with that, like, do you, like, how are you going to rectify things? I know you're going to have the translators on from the DS version, things like that, an interview or and such. Like, how are you going to work that into all the discussion of realism in there?
Well, the chapter that was published as an excerpt is, again, just an excerpt. And out of context, you know, it's it makes it look like the whole book is
about
this. Yeah,
well, yeah, maybe that's a good point. Like, what's the scope of this going
to
be?
The book is kind of just... an approach to Chrono Trigger from every angle I could possibly imagine. From a personal angle of me playing it and kind of sympathizing with the character of Chrono as much as, you know, you can really do that, to how the party sort of obeys and defies these you know, stereotypes of party, things about, you know, their race, gender, sexuality in the world. Again, the Kotaku excerpt was sort of panning out even further and seeing what the world is like around them. But I talk about, you know, some other things like what the Day of Lavos really means from a country that has suffered so many disasters, especially a really prominent nuclear disaster coupled with a natural disaster, the March 11, 2011, Fukushima nuclear power plant explosion, and then the huge earthquake and all that stuff. How, you know, does a country so embedded with nuclear terror interpret Lavos? And there's a lot of things of using connections between Japan and the game, and between my life and my life in Japan, where I lived for some time in the game. So, you know, I use a lot of, I guess, associative memory to bring up things that I feel matter to talk about. And everyone has kind of a story behind the games that they love, and this is mine, and I feel like it's got a lot of cool stuff that I think people will enjoy reading about.
So was this the thing that got you in, like, Japanese studies? That's one thing I noticed in sort of your biography that was sort of the really quick thing on Boss Fight Books, just sort of, you know, brief thing. You mentioned that you taught English in Japan, and obviously you work in the Japanese, I guess, is it collections or at university?
Yeah. It's a Japanese department of the library. We buy stuff from Japan and Korea as well. So I'm surrounded by Japanese every day.
But so what got you interested in even going into Japan? Like, what was your, was it video games as a whole that then kicked you off into more of that study proper and more, you know, learning, you know, getting into doing all the things, or was there something else that kind of, you know, steered your academic career, so to speak, that way?
When I was younger, I absolutely loved whatever little anime we got from Japan. I think I'm talking way back of like Dragon Ball when it appeared on what became the WB locally. And it was heavily censored, heavily edited, but I really loved this show. And then Cartoon Network brought out Toonami some years later, and I was just fascinated with just this kind of style of animation I'd never seen, and followed it, you know, rabidly. So I started collecting bits of Dragon Ball manga. Some of it I found at, you know, weird comic shops, and it was all in Japanese, and I love the artwork, and I really wanted to, you know, untangle the puzzle of this. So I think a lot of people who learn Japanese, especially people in the States, are interested in, you know, anime, manga, they love video games, and they want to get deeper into that field and learn more and feel what's the real story behind it, you know, thinking like maybe our English experience isn't kind of authentic enough. But for me, it was more about a fascination of the Japanese language and seeing it as this thing that totally was packed with meaning, and I couldn't understand a fucking word of it. So I started kind of teaching myself a little bit. I didn't get very far with that. But, you know, I learned some of the basics of reading and writing and thought, this is something I want to do. So when I finally went to college, I decided I would abandon everything I knew about other languages and just focus on Japanese. And after 4 years of studying it, I graduated and got a job teaching and bumming around in Japan.
What did you do exactly for teaching? Because there's so many different ways to teach English in Japan. I'm kind of curious which way you went.
I was a participant in the JET program.
That's what I was going to.
Government sponsored.
That's exactly what I was about to ask. Were you part of the JET? Because, like, I know I've had many of friends who've gone through JET, and explained about JET and talked about it. Of course, there's the famous blogger. I forgot the guy's name, but he was like, I think it was like the guide to JET. Like, whatever. I can't remember what this guy's name is. He's like he had the, I think it was like Super Gaijin or something like that. I forgot. It's a more internet thing, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this guy.
I may have to find this because it was such an interesting article, because this guy was sort of an African American who went essentially to teach English in Japan through the JET program, and like had an entirely different experience, obviously, in there and things like
and
that.
That's kind of important to note, because in my book, I will talk about, you know, how race looks in RPGs, especially JRPGs, when it's a world devoid of people of any other color, but sort of a peachy, whitish color. But there was a guy in my program, he was my neighbor, and he was a black guy from Canada. he was stopped by the police a few times. He was never, you know, detained or questioned, but they always wanted to know who he was and what he was doing there. But meanwhile, all of, you know, the white people in our crew never had any problems.
Interesting. Wow.
There's just different racial attitudes in Japan, and some of them unfortunately align with how things are done in the U.S. But it's a very different experience to be a white person in Japan than it is to be a black person in Japan than it is to be an obviously not Japanese Asian person in Japan. Just, you know, I don't know those experiences firsthand, but I've just heard people's stories.
No, and so have I, especially in that. But we're not here to talk down about Japan, of course. This is just
context for a culture that created a product, and that product ended up getting translated and shipped to us, and then it's sold to us almost as if it's not Japanese. So even though you have this fond memory of the Shin Hatsubai, you know, dialogue, it's totally English product by the time it gets here, because it's passed through, you know, multiple translators who know Japan. Ted Woolsey was a Japanese language or Japanese literature scholar, rather, and Tom Slattery, who's the DS translator, was also a JET program participant. So,
oh wow, you know,
these are people who know Japan and know what was going on and kind of knew what to play up and what to play down, I guess.
Well, because that's the thing when it comes to, and this is not so much translation, it's actually localization, and this becomes even more in-depth, because I know a lot of people, when it comes to anime and when it comes to, you know, voice dub, especially when it comes to that, people are like very touchy. It's like, oh, that's not, you're not translating the exact words. And I don't think anyone quite understands what goes into localization, because that's what essentially happens. A lot of these sort of products, they get localized. You know, certain things in terms of humor that may work in Japan don't work here, and vice versa. And so you get a lot of kind of weird things. Like I know in Chrono Trigger, if you go to the developers area, if you get like the special ending, especially essentially where you start up a new game plus beat Lavos right out the gate through the green portal, you end up going to sort of developers area, sort of the dialogue from the guys that made in Japan. And there's some weird, very specific Japanese jokes in there from what I understand.
Yes, and there's some really specific American references. I think one of them says something like, how about those bears, or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. It's just like...
I've gone through that ending, and this is kind of a... I don't want to give away too much from the book, but... if you really play through that ending, oh man, do you realize that is not a treat? That is one of the most depressing, horrific endings of, hated working on the game. They just complain. It's a, you know, I really enjoyed writing about this, and I had to restrain myself from dropping a lot of F-bombs.
Well, because it's like working on a game, especially at that point in time, and even now to this day, it is a process. It's like any other creative process, and you can probably tell more about this from a book perspective yourself. Like working on the book that you have, in fact, we're going to draw some comparisons now to that developer's ending to yours. Working on this book, how has that process worked out for you?
Well, it's largely been good because, so with Boss Fight Books, it's a small new publisher. Basically, it's the heroic work of one guy, Gabe Durham, who had this idea and he wanted to make it work. So he and Ken Bauman, who was an actor, he's now studying in Santa Fe. He had the idea to write Earthbound. And, you know, they decided, well, if Gabe will make the series, then Ken will write the book Earthbound and we'll get it from there. So they gathered some other people who knew games and had ideas about what game they'd like to talk about, and kind of set up the series that would be essentially one author, one game. Nothing about, you know, here's the history of games in general. It would be, here's that one specific game you love. So, you know, with Ken, he had Earthbound, and another guy, John Irwin, is writing about Super Mario Brothers 2. You know, and it's not about the franchise or about the general concept of Super Mario. It's just this specific game is the object of his study.
Now, here's a question really quick, because I don't know, is it, Are you talking Doki Doki Panic? Or are you talking like Lost Levels?
To be honest, I don't know the exact manuscript, but I'm pretty sure he's talking about Doki Doki Panic, which actually was kind of a Mario game until they scrapped it for Doki Doki Panic, and then it became Super Mario Brothers 2 here. It's got a really convoluted history that I don't know super well. But
I only know like certain things, but I'll definitely check that. Okay, but sorry to interrupt you. I apologize.
But each book is focused on, you know, a specific game. Where was I going with
this? Well, I mean, it's the idea of because, like, you read the description of the book, and it mentions that, like, we took a vote on, like, you know,
yes,
all, like, what game you all want to see written, and you all pick Chrono Trigger. And I guess, you know, because it sounds like these guys were picked, these guys were sort of at the beginning. Like, were you there from day one, or did you go?
I was the latest comer to this. Those other five authors, they were all part of this package that they were selling as part of Kickstarter.
Right.
And at the time the Kickstarter was launched, they had the idea that these five books are definitely getting written. These are the five people who are definitely writing them. So part of the Kickstarter was, if you support this, if we end up getting funded, we're going to have a sixth title, and the backers of this project will choose what that title is. So it ended up coming down to a bunch of different, you know, tallies, and finally Chrono Trigger was in hot competition with one of the Zelda games. I'm not sure if it was, there was a bit of wiggle room. One of the Metroid games, and something else was on there, but it ended up being that Chrono Trigger won. So the publisher, well, Gabe / Boss Fight Books, said, okay, well, you chose the game, now you write it. So they solicited a pitch for the game, and I was aware of the project. I had backed it on Kickstarter, so I said, you know what, I'm gonna throw my hat into the ring there. So I went, I didn't have a copy of the game to play, so I went onto YouTube and I just watched 10 hours of someone run through the game. I mean, it was obsessive and crazy, and I felt like I was going mad by the third hour, but I watched the entirety of this thing and was taking notes and saying, ah, yes, of course, that. And I started writing an outline as I'm watching this guy, you know, play through the game, and just wrote up a proposal to them. And I guess they liked it because they picked me to write the book about it. So, you know, I'm very happy to do it.
Well, because, I mean, it's like I said, with Chrono Trigger, that is a very tough thing. Was there at any point in time in the writing of the book that you, like, you have a pitch, and you pitch a certain way, and you you have an idea for what a project's going to be, and yes, you make an outline, you go through the in-depth in game, you have kind of a plan. Was there any point in time that somewhere in there that what you thought was going to be the premise, like, completely changed somewhere? Or was it like, that was like, this is the path I'm going and there's no deviation?
No, I was kind of aware of what Gabe wanted from the series, having read, there's an excerpt of Earthbound on Kotaku as well. Same article author, Luke Plunkett, has posted that. I loved it. I loved how he approached the book. And I knew that this is the kind of approach that Boss Fight Books wanted to do. Something that was both intensely personal but highly critical at the same time. And nothing that read like fiction, nothing that read game review. I mean, part of that can be a game review, but it was more about engaging this thing, like, not only as a literary text to be read or experienced, like a, you know, I guess, analysis of a movie, but also how you feel about it because you're a participant in it. So I saw that Ken had done this so well, and I had an idea of, well, you know, I have my own kinds of engagements with Chrono Trigger, and I'm going to do that. So I wrote a very, very dark. I mean, it was, I must have been like having a bad week.
Yeah, yeah. What was your pitch like? Like, how did you do it?
My pitch was a chapter on the Day of Lavos. And I was just reflecting on what my life had been in Japan, and then having gone back to Fukushima, where I had lived in 2009, and sort of feeling like I didn't belong there anymore, and it just felt so empty. And then 2 years later, there was this horrible disaster that basically ruined the city that I had loved, and all the children I had taught were probably moved away because their parents were afraid of radiation, and it was just so sad. So I kind of channeled this into thinking about, well, how do people in Chrono Trigger deal with disaster? Because this is a game about an epic disaster. I mean, that's the whole premise of the game. We've got to stop this horrible thing from happening. And I just kind of tried to equate those two things together. And, you know, it was really emotional for me. And you know, obviously I'm, you know, typing and I'm like, oh God, I'm crying.
Well, yeah, because you're bringing in your real life experience, and I like the fact that you kind of pointed out right now that you're taking a literary approach to it. Me as an English major, kind of looking at games as art in that kind of regard, like, I am super glad to hear that that's how it's going to be treated. That's how it's going to be analyzed. Because a lot of people, when it comes to game kind of analysis, and, you know, when we talk about it, it's rare that people treat it like literature and will look at it that way. And so, like I said, I'm glad to hear that. I'm also glad to hear the kind of personal stuff kind of coming in. So you made this pitch. It's a really dark pitch, very, you know, talking about the Day of Lavos, the entire end times.
Yeah, it was some heavy stuff. I thought, geez, they're going to think I'm like such a sad ass walking around. I don't even know if that's a word, but I think
I like the idea.
It's probably right. But it contained, you know, what I think passed for a message of hope, and that I believed that this isn't all about gloom and doom. There's a message behind it, but it's not a simple message of we need to believe and hope, you know, nothing like that. But because that's something the game suggests, and I'm not shy to criticize where the game gets a little cutesy poo. So it's not strictly literary either, because that's a huge part of it. But it's also developmental of, you know, why this line was chosen for this audience, or maybe who wrote this part of the game, because the game is a product of many people. So, you know, I also look at the people behind the text a little bit and the circumstances of it. A lot of peripheral stuff, like I said, the strategy guides, which help inform the user about the game. Because when you played, you know, original NES or Super Nintendo games before the internet, the manual was the best you had of documentation. So sometimes the backstory of the game was in the manual, and the game just starts with you setting out. So, you know, that's kind of part of the experience you had. And I even went back and, you know, looked at that old manual that I had. And
God, I had not looked at that manual in years. Cause like the one I remember in my head that gives more of a backstory for a game specifically was, I think, the Legend of Zelda manual has this, like, you know, giant, like, history of the game and the world and animation, yes, things like that. So that's always one to come to mind.
It is, oh, God, it is, yes, a beautiful little thing with all those great monster artworks. I actually love, you know, the bestiaries that are in these manuals. I'm obsessed with them. So I was very happy to get these crazy Japanese strategy guides and see that, unlike the English Chrono Trigger strategy guide, they were very colorful and have lots of neat shit in them, really. I mean, I have one right in front of me. It's got a scratch-off game where you're supposed to find Magus, and then you could send it away. And if they picked you, you'd win a prize, some hologram cards of the game.
I mean, wow.
Yeah, there's some neat stuff. And here we got, you know, kind of like VCR instructions.
Well, because the thing is that during that time, like, you know, if I were to be really honest, the Super Nintendo was the sort of the was like the beginning of being serious about RPGs. Like, yes, we had Dragon's Quest during, you know, the NES days, but we really didn't have too many, like, hardcore RPGs. We got Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, and that's about it. We missed, you know, 2 and 3 proper for the NES, so, like, nothing came out. Obviously, Earthbound Zero, you know, the, you know, whole Mother series kind of debacle. You know, we never really got that, but come the Super Nintendo with, you know, Final Fantasy 2, which is 4, we have Chrono Trigger on there, we have Earthbound, we have Enix in its complete prime, bringing in all these different kind of games. Like, that was kind of the beginning of all these sort of RPGs, so, you know.
Well, actually, I think Enix, when I really looked back, I realized why I love Square so much. It's because Enix just stopped producing RPGs for the Super Nintendo. Their heyday in the US was basically at the NES. Like, they stopped with Dragon Warrior 4, which was probably Dragon Quest 4. I don't really know how their numbering system all worked out. But it just seems that, from what I've read, Japanese marketing departments didn't think Americans would play RPGs. They thought this is too Japanese, too weird. So they were kind of hesitant to send them overseas and to invest in translating them and localizing them. So sooner or later, we got Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, which was supposed to be like this training wheels RPG. But by then we had already had so many. So it just seemed that for years, this, I don't know, mythology of the American gamer as not interested in story-driven games persisted in Japan. And they're like, guess what? We need to really – we got a lot of great games coming out, but we need to train the Americans on how to play them. So we're going to give them this very simple game.
Well, yeah, because like when that came out, it was – I mean, like, if I think of all the games that came out just that were like the games that I love – I think all of them are RPGs, like Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy, Illusion of Gaia, Secret of Mana. Heck, even I like Robotrek, and that was like kind of a kiddie RPG. So it's funny you bring this up, the idea of that mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely changed. I think that they know that there's a market here, and they're willing to invest in the resources to do it. But Square really only got on board with this idea in the Super Nintendo era, and that was after Final Fantasy II. So slash four. It's so hard to talk about these games. You always have to double number them just to make sure everyone knows where we're at. But when they hired Ted Woolsey to do some translations, they were basically taking a step in the right direction, saying, look, we know we have some really crappy translations like Final Fantasy II, which had a lot of awkward lines. Many of them are well-loved now. Oh, yeah. But Woolsey was like a step of saying, we're taking this seriously. But they still had the idea of Americans need guidance on how to play RPGs, so make Mystic Quest happen. And they did, and I played it and thought, this is way too easy. I knew how to play RPGs. I had already played them. So why they were reluctant to accept that Americans really wanted this genre is a little beyond me. But it's a country that's often resistant to change.
Back then it was sort of a lot. You had a lot more to gamble. I mean, you still have a lot of gamble on gaming, but you had a lot more then. It's funny when you bring up Mystic Quest. I can't remember. I think that was the only Final Fantasy that lets you use Cure on the final enemy to kill him or something like that. Like, I know you could do...
I didn't realize that. That's an interesting thing.
I know you could do something bizarre with Cure and like specifically that, and it's something like it's a very vague memory, so I might be completely wrong. Because I never played Mystic Quest, but I had a friend of mine that played it. And, by that point, I too was into RPGs. I was already kind of getting more in depth. And so I'd see him going these like individual blocks and attacking a certain amount of enemies. Like, what the hell are you doing? Where's the random encounters? Where's all this other stuff?
Well, that was actually kind of a cool step. I'm not going to argue that Mystic Quest prefigured this, you can see the enemy type of thing. But that's one of the features of Chrono Trigger and things like Secret of Mana. That is the best part, really. Like, the random encounter, sometimes they can be so annoying when you're just walking, you're like, oh great, there's a little village, oh, pixels are everywhere, fuck, it's a monster. So that, how did they not see that thing coming? It's a monster. So in Chrono Trigger, in Mystic Quest, you would basically go up and press the A button and be like, hi monster, I'll engage you in battle, and then you'd fight it, because monsters like to do that. But otherwise, they're just hanging around waiting for you to pick a fight. It's like being in a bar or something. Everyone's drunk and just itching for it.
Well, that's what was cool about Chrono Trigger, too. You're right. You bring up the whole idea of there not being that random encounter, because at that point in time, that was Square's bread and butter. Like, that was like, you were having a random, you're playing a game, Squaresoft, random encounter time. And it's funny you bring that up, because like, there were ways that if you knew what to do, if you knew how to kind of skate around and kind of hit that one pixel that you wouldn't aggro it, that you could like skip battles. Like, I remember me personally doing that so many times in the forest right before Guardia Castle. Just like, all right, when I have to go back there for something, like, all right, run around here, go there, don't engage that. Boom, I'm back in Guardia Castle, and nothing, nothing would hurt me. I guess as we're kind of coming to the end of this time, we're not quite out of time yet, but we're kind of approaching it. So here's the question. I mean, yes, Chrono Trigger got picked, and yes, you pitched it, but like, why do it at all? I mean, why, what is it about this specific game besides all the personal stuff and besides all the things you've got that, I mean, cause you talking about all the things you've had, there could have been almost, not saying any other game could have been placed, but there's plenty of other games out there that have kind of a very deep connection to Japanese culture. You could
pull,
So why see, why Chrono Trigger?
Well, honestly, you'll have to ask the people who voted for it. whom I was,
then there you go. Like, why did you vote for Chrono Trigger? Like, why didn't you vote for, let's say, Final Fantasy VI or Super Metroid or Legend of Zelda: Link to the Past or any of the other, we talk about the Super Nintendo era or the Super Famicom era if you're in Japan. There is a plethora of, like, well-known titles that people put in the holiest of high regards.
So why this one?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, by the time I actually voted, this was among those top choices. But anyway,
I'm just going to put my vote with the support of the winning team.
But I wasn't really, following the crowd or anything. I just thought, hey, this game has a lot of cool stuff about it. And what really intrigued me was that unlike the Final Fantasy series, which kind of spawned a franchise of sorts, Chrono Trigger kind of failed to do that. So how did this game that was so popular, that has been released and re-released many times, why is it just this one game being released? Why aren't we playing Chrono Trigger 7 by now? I was really interested in seeing what happened to the series. And I was aware of Chrono Cross, which, again, is not part of my book very much because it's focused on Chrono Trigger, not the series. But what happened in between those games? Why do I have such good memories of Chrono Trigger, and why is Chrono Cross this thing that I, you know, barely got through disc one of? I think it was two discs.
Yeah, about three, actually. You know, I think.
Why didn't I care about the Chrono Trigger franchise anymore, but why did I still have such fond memories for this particular game? And I was really just intrigued by that, and I felt nostalgic, too. The part of boss fight's appeal is, like, we are appealing to your nostalgia. These are classic games. It's not, you know, we're not writing a book about, I don't know, a game that came out last year. I really don't know what's coming out anymore. But we're not writing a game about Skyrim. You know, that's we're writing a games that affected how you experience life, that changed you, that became part of your own personal mythology. So this game is definitely one of those for me, and I couldn't resist the chance to try and write a book about it, or even just get my ideas heard. And this was the best way I could do it. After I saw Ken's approach, I thought, this is something I want to do. I don't want to argue fan theory on forums. I don't want to tell people, no, you're wrong because X, Y, and Z. I want to approach this from just a lot of different ways and kind of figure out what it still means to me now and see how I developed, I guess, as a person through it. I have a lot of complex feelings about it, and plus I've been, you know, analyzing the game, overanalyzing myself. I've been searching, you know, my document for flaws, for fact errors, and lots of crazy things. So I've just been so into Chrono Trigger these past like 8 months.
Well, you've been writing a damn book on it. What do you? I mean, you've been writing. You've been steeped in it as if it were academia.
And I really have. I mean, I'm analyzing the text in these strategy guides, which has been a blast to do. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to read through all of them, but they're full of interviews with the developers. And the one that I have in front of me, the earliest one published, is sort of like a extra special magazine issue. And it has interviews with like the Japanese preteens who played a beta version and how they felt about it. And I just look at this thing that obviously was so big, so new, or at least presented as such, and I just wanted to see how it connected to everything it possibly could. And I wanted to find as many of those connections as I could and put them in this book and say, look what I've done, and make something that was not encyclopedic, but more like a holistic view that made you remember why you love this game, not remember why you didn't follow every fact, if that makes any sense. You know?
No, you're right. We are pretty much out of time, but there's one important question we have to ask. There's one very, very critical question I have to ask, because, you know, everything we've talked about up to this point was actually leading to this question. Seriously, who does have the best lemon bars?
Oh my God. It is, it was Flying Monkey Bakery in Philadelphia, but has changed to Metropolitan because they have the expert amount of crunch, tanginess, and sweetness, size-wise and price-wise. It cannot be beat, except for my kind of sort of aunt who makes amazing lemon bars. So I'm sure she'll never listen to this. But Cammy, if you're listening, I love your lemon bars, and I want them now.
Like just this is all been a ploy to get you to answer the question.
Yes, I'm actually sending her this MP3 when it's posted. Be like, oh, those lemon bars we discussed. It has been excellent conspiring with you, Roberto.
Oh, totally. Mike, it's been a complete pleasure. I'm looking forward to the book. I know when it comes out, I'll be buying it right day one, if not in pre-order now. But for those who want to, or interested, where can people find all the details of the book and find more about, you know, more about you, good sir?
Well, probably Google helps, but bossfightbooks.com. You can find me on there. The book will be released as an ebook and as a print book. And if you buy the print version, you'll also get e-versions as well. It's slated for release on April 1st of this year. It may be sooner. It may be later. I am deep into edits right now. We're mostly finished, but we just want to make it absolutely perfect for release. And I hope you, Roberto, and any of your listeners will enjoy reading it.
Oh, I know my listeners will enjoy. They've heard me rant and rave about this game for years. They've seen me, if they've watched me play it during the Extra Life streams, trying to beat it in 24 hours. It's, again, one of those games that I guarantee just the name Chrono Trigger. I have friends who adore that game. And, it, you know, we talk about it as like this... Oh God, that's a great game. It's a beautiful game. It's one of those games that you can play today, be fun. Like I've told people before, if you want to play,
it's fun. It's a fun game. I mean, I've analyzed it and almost probably destroyed it from an analytical perspective. But it's a fun game. It holds up and it makes you want to play it. I didn't play this begrudgingly as an adult. I really enjoyed my second run through this game as an adult, and I can see why people love it. And
there's a lot to love,
but you know, if you can keep your fingers glued on the control paddle, basically, this is a good game.
It's a great game. Well, of course, thanks, Beyond Mike. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 on the Twitters. If you want to talk more about this episode, talk about your memories of Chrono Trigger, what you loved, what you didn't love, you know, what you're going to bring to when we read this book, go to our website, cosmicradio.tv/8bitlife. There you'll find links to show notes, previous episodes, and of course, everything else revolves a little 8-bit world of mine and my other shows, such as, speaking of which, Retro Fun Time, which is my little... retro gaming thing that kind of takes more of an artistic approach to classic video games and a little laughs there now and then.
I love a good laugh.
So do I. That's the show for today. So tune in next week. We'll talk to another geek about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people.
Bye.